So we'll use that here. The genesis of this actually, I think sometime last year, Mr. Farr was teaching Sunday school, and he made some comment about church-state issues and said, you know, maybe sometime we could have Dr. Sidwell talk to us about that in Sunday school. And I thought, oh, he might ask me to do that. So I started thinking about it. And so I kind of strung thoughts together, and eventually, of course, when Tim came and asked me to fill in this Sunday, I thought, well, maybe this is a time to do it, to talk about this idea, because we, of course, we've just gone through the sections dealing with the magistrate and so on in the Confession of Faith. And this is not directly related to that, but it kind of orients us to what it means when we talk about church and state and separation of church and state and issues like this and how they all fit together. So we're going to do kind of a quick overview from basically ancient history to relatively early modern history. My wife asked me, said, have you ever done anything like this before? And I started thinking, well, I said, in Rome class, I talk about Constantine and what he did. And then in Middle Ages class, I talk about the whole church-state issues and conflicts then. And then Reformation, we talk about the reformers and what they said and thought and did. And I'm not as much on American history, but in my History of Religion in America class, we talked about the Constitution and some of the formation and issues behind it. So I thought, well, if I take from all these different places and kind of all come together into hopefully one presentation. We're going to start here with a famous passage in Matthew chapter 22, and I'm going to read from verse 15 if you want to follow along. Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent out unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Master, we know that thou art true and teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, Why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money. And they brought him a penny. And he saith unto them, Whose is the image and superscription? They say unto him, Caesar's. Then saith he unto them, Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God. And when they had heard these words, they marveled and left him, and went their way. Now, whenever you start talking about issues of church and state, quite often you'll come back to this passage, rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar, and what is unto God what is God's. And I'm not going to attempt to go through and teach this passage, just give you a couple of preliminary thoughts that will help us as we think about this subject here. The context, this is in a series of questions that Jesus' enemies are trying to trick him with, to trip him up over. In this case, it says the Pharisees and the Herodians came and asked. And that's interesting right there. Because, of course, the Pharisees were the strict Jewish religious group. And the Herodians were a pro-Herod faction, the Herod dynasty, who basically were more of a political faction, more sympathetic to the Romans. So it's interesting that a religious faction and a political faction came together to ask this question. And of course, most of us recognize what's going on here. They said, well, we can ask him this question. If he says, don't pay the tribute, don't pay the taxes, that'll infuriate the Romans and we can get him. But if he says, do pay the tribute, do pay the taxes, the people will be offended because they resent it. And they thought, surely, one way or the other, they will capture him. And of course, our Lord gives this very adroit answer there to them. Now, just to take away a couple of points from this as we look at our subject here, I think we would want to notice here, of course, that Jesus is saying there are legitimate spheres of authority or sovereignty. Some of you may be familiar with the Dutch theologian Abraham Kuyper. Kuyper was a theologian as well as a politician in the Netherlands, late 19th, early 20th centuries. And he actually had a theory based on what he saw as teachings like this of sphere sovereignty, that God endows certain institutions, church, family, government, with a sovereignty, with a rule, and one is not to impinge on the other there. What we just want to take away is that what Jesus is saying here is that Caesar, that is the state, the government, has some authority we must acknowledge. We may debate about what are the limits of that authority, what are the limitations of that authority, but there's no questioning that governments have legitimate authority given to them by God in his sovereignty here. Now, in the early history of the church, the New Testament era, and then for 200 years after the close of the New Testament, we have to understand that In the Roman Empire, as far as Christians were concerned, church and state were separate. Now, for the Romans, religion and state were not separate. The Romans, of course, had their official public religion. There was the worship of the traditional Roman gods, Jupiter and Mars and all the rest of that. The emperor would lead in this quite often. They would build temples, have public celebrations. In fact, one of the titles that had developed back in the Roman Republic day was the Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest, the lead priest, who was in charge of all the public worship of the Romans. And eventually, the emperors took on that title under the imperial period. And of course, as many of you know, eventually, the papacy picked up on that title after the Christianization, so to speak, of the Roman Empire there as well. So the Romans had the idea of a state religion, but there was no thought of the Christian church being part of, ruled by the government in this way. Now, the Jews, for example, under the kingdom of Israel, the Jews would have what we might call a union of church and state, if you want to call it that. I mean, obviously, the king, the high priest, the others were all given their authority. All were to worship and follow this. There was no depending on how faithful the Israelites were, there was to be no allowance of a worship of other gods and the like there as well. But by the time of the Romans, of course, the Jews themselves were separate. They were given a protected status under the Roman Empire, kind of a payback for some help that the Jews had given to Julius Caesar and the like there. And so the Jews were simply separate, and the Romans, basically, as long as they kept quiet, as long as they didn't cause any trouble, the Romans let them alone. You remember in Acts 18, that famous account where in Corinth they bring Paul before the Roman proconsul Gallio, and they start complaining about Paul. And Gallio says, if this is a matter of you and your religion, if this is a matter of you and your theology, I don't have anything to do with that. Go away. And he drove them away, and they began to beat the leader of the synagogue and all of this. The Romans didn't see this as something that they really were supposed to be involved with at all. And of course, Christians, there was no such thing as a union with the state. I mean, the state was hostile. It was persecuting. It was at least always critical here as well. Christianity was usually not considered what would be seen as a legitimate or legal religion there as well. So that's the way it was from the time of Christ for about 300 years. The change takes place with the Emperor Constantine. Now, I hope I don't, I don't want to bury you guys with too much, historical data and all this sort of thing. I want to give you enough history background so that you can see what the story is. So the main thing we're focusing on here is how does the government, the state, relate to the church here? Constantine, why is he so important? Why do we talk about him so much? I mean, depending on your knowledge of history, you probably have heard of Constantine at least. Of course, some of you know more about him and could even say things about him here as well. Well, he was trying to become emperor. All right, the Roman Empire had its ups and downs. And in the 200s, the Roman Empire came close to falling apart. But right at the end of the 200s, there came to power a man named Diocletian, an emperor. And he put everything back together. He strengthened the state. And he also instituted the most harsh persecution of Christianity that Christians had ever endured under the Romans. Well, after Diocletian was passed, there was again a competition, and Constantine was looking to take over the imperial throne. So he laid claim to the throne, he raised an army, he began to battle some of the other combatants, and he also accepted Christianity. Now this is, of course, the key moment here. According to the accounts that he later described to others, one night before the Battle of Milvian Bridge, which would be the big battle which would determine his fate and the fate of his cause, he says that he saw a sign in the heavens, or perhaps he dreamed this. It's not necessarily clear, but supposedly he saw a sign of the cross and had these words, "In this sign conquer." And in fact, he went and had crosses put on the shields of his soldiers. And the next day they went forth, they defeated his enemy, and Constantine rose to power in this way. So then he began to basically to turn to an embrace of the Christian church in some way. Why is this important? Well, for one thing, it ended the persecution. Constantine immediately stopped the persecution that Diocletian and others had been practicing alone. People debate the sincerity. What was Constantine doing? Why was he doing this? And the fact is, We just don't know. And there's all kinds of suggestions. Some suggest that he saw Christianity as a convenient kind of glue to put his empire together. After all, the empire had nearly fallen apart 50 years before. It got divided up into little sub-kingdoms. So maybe this new Christian religion will be a new way to join the people together in some way. Maybe he had some kind of a dream or a vision. People often did that, and he thought, well, maybe I should go this way. Maybe he was superstitious. There's a lot of evidence, though, that shows that his conversion was sure not thorough and perhaps not sincere, but I'm not going to go through all of that at this point. What I do want to note is he began to give support to the church. He didn't just end persecution. He made the state friendly toward the church. He gave back church buildings that the government had seized. Where buildings had been destroyed, he gave funds to rebuild them. For example, most of you have heard of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, which, if you know your Reformation history, the church was trying to build a new St. Peter's, which is the one that's there right now, and that's why they were selling indulgences and infuriated Luther and all that. But the one they replaced was built by Constantine. He built that one, and it lasted for over 1,000 years until the Catholic Church replaced it with a new St. Peter's, the one that stands in Rome today. So he began to give this kind of financial support. He began to intervene on behalf of the church. Maybe you remember hearing about the Council of Nicaea, or early church council, which came together to refute the teaching of Arius that Jesus was not God. It's Constantine who called that. He wanted them to get together, figure this thing out, solve it, because he wanted unity. And he certainly didn't want them arguing and divided over these issues anymore there as well. So he began to give support to the church. So what's the result of this with Constantine? Well, it's not true, as I always tell my students, Constantine is not the one who made Christianity the state church of the Roman Empire, but he's the one that started the ball rolling. He gave his support. He gave funds. He protected them. And of course, you got to realize a lot of people thinking, if you want to get on the emperor's good side, maybe you should support these Christians too, whatever you actually think about them or feel about them as well. And so it began this movement. About a generation or so after Constantine, another emperor named Theodosius came along, and he's the one that actually said, okay, now Christianity is going to be the state church, the official religion of the Roman Empire. Theodosius still let people be non-Christians, but you couldn't worship other religions. For example, you could still be a pagan under Theodosius, but they couldn't have pagan temples, you couldn't have pagan sacrifices, that sort of thing. And eventually, of course, this went even further to where they didn't allow any kind of religious dissent from the official so-called Christian faith as it arose there in the late Roman Empire and into medieval Europe then. This is often called in history the Constantinian settlement. In other words, this is how church and state are going to function for well over 1,000 years. In fact, in some places, you still have the remnants of the Constantinian settlement. Any place you still have an official established state church, like, say, the United Kingdom, it may be a very small and weak established church, but it's still kind of a one hangover of this idea here, of this whole thing. So we have this change. Now, there's some changes that take place in the church. I think it's worth noting here, too. My textbook in my History of Rome class by a secular author used it for years. And Dr. Masco, in fact, when he taught the class, he used this textbook before me. But the author of that book, a secular writer, made an observation I thought was interesting. He said, prior to Constantine and the embrace of the state, the church had to rely on persuasion to change people's minds, to get them either to adhere or correct. You might have a church discipline kind of structure where the church could perhaps put someone out of its fellowship. But the fact is, you fundamentally relied on persuading people. Once the state embraces it, we move to a model of coercion, because now you can have the state enforce this. It was after the Council of Nicaea, Constantine's the one that exiled the false teachers. You can now rely on state power to enforce your will, to enforce your policies. And in fact, it goes even further. The Reformation historian John Fox says the church at Rome went from being a persecuted church in the early centuries of our history here, Christian era, to being a persecuting church And of course, eventually it was involved in persecuting. Of course, Fox knew that very well, as he recorded in his writings. So Constantine marks this very big, significant shift. And what we're actually going to be seeing here is kind of how they people work out and live with this shift until we get to a different model toward the end of this lesson. All right, so what happens? Let's jump from the Roman Empire into the Middle Ages. Now, the Middle Ages are very dominated by what I call a vision of Christendom. Now, we hear the term Christendom. We see it as well. Essentially, Christendom is the idea that the Church of God and the Kingdom of Christ are made visible bodily in essentially Europe. In other words, you know, if you're a premillennialist like I am, you think of what a visible expression of the kingdom would be, of course, the millennial kingdom, ultimately there. Well, here they're saying the expression of God's rule is seen here in the states, government structures of Europe in the Middle Ages, and in fact, beyond that. They think of a Christian Europe, though we see a lot of holes and flaws with that. Now, the reason I'm explaining is because that's important when you try to understand church and state. They thought in terms of, well, although there may be different kingdoms and so on, we're still one Christian commonwealth, so to speak. And we have two leaders. We have leading us spiritually, the Pope. And you know, you have to have a Pope. He's the spiritual leader. He is the spiritual guide. He is the successor of Peter, so they will say. But they also say we need a physical, visible, political leader. And that's the emperor. Now, that's the one that sometimes people miss when they look at this. The fact is, I mean, they thought we've got to have a pope and we've got to have an emperor. And that's really the two halves of God's administration for his kingdom here. You always have to have an emperor. First of all, where does he come from? Well, right, the Roman Empire fell in Western Europe in the 400s. But what a lot of people don't realize is the Eastern Roman Empire lasted another 1,000 years. We sometimes call this the Byzantine Empire, although that name actually came after it was gone. So you still had an emperor. So at first you got the Pope and the Emperor at Constantinople. But the Pope and the Emperor often were at odds with each other. And the Emperor in Constantinople is way over there, you know, to the Western European way of thinking. So what if we had a closer emperor? And so on Christmas Day in the year 800, the Pope crowns the Frankish King Charlemagne emperor. Now, you know, I used to teach this to my freshmen. It used to be in history. And I said, you know, they probably thought about, I don't know if any of them ever said this or not, but why did they do it? I mean, he was already king. He already had a kingdom. He already had a big kingdom. So why did he want to suddenly make him an emperor? He didn't get any more territory for it, because now he's the designated leader of these of Christendom. We've got our Pope now, we've got another emperor now, and this emperor is closer to us, and he can help the Pope against his enemies and so on. Well, that lasted for a while until Charlemagne's empire kind of dissolved. So then in the late 900s, they came up with another one. You may have heard this term, the Holy Roman Empire. That's essentially Germany. But they didn't call it Germany back then. They called it the Holy Roman Empire. Now, Voltaire famously said the Holy Roman Empire wasn't holy or Roman or an empire. Well, it was an empire. It wasn't too Roman because it was basically German. Holy depends on how you view this whole idea of a Christendom. But now again, we've got, you see, this sometimes confuses some of my students again. They see, we've got a king of France and a king of England and an emperor of Germany or a Holy Roman Emperor. Well, because they saw this emperor's role needed to be there. And in fact, they developed what was called in the Middle Ages the two swords theory. That basically, our government, the government of Europe, of Christendom, consists of a spiritual sword given to the Pope and an earthly, temporal, political sword given to the emperor. And the idea is that Pope and emperor will work together here to rule in this way. There are proof texts. I might just read this to you quickly from, to turn to Luke chapter 22. Jesus speaking to his disciples, and he said unto them, "When I sent you without purse and scrip and shoes, lacked ye anything?" And they said, "Nothing." Then said he unto them, "But now he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say unto you that this is written, that this that is written must be yet be accomplished in me. And he was reckoned among the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end. And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said unto them, it is enough. Now, the interpretation of that passage is itself kind of one of those convoluted. What did Jesus mean when he said, the two swords, it's enough? I won't really get off on that here. But what the Middle Ages said, the two swords were the two parts of government. One sword to be given, as I said, to the church, to the Pope. One sword to get given to the empire, to the emperor here in this way. In fact, I have a medieval drawing I show my students on this point. And this portrays Christ sitting on a throne with two swords. And he's handing one sword to the Pope, and he's handing one sword to the emperor. Although in this art, the artist has Christ looking at the Pope, which of course suggests which one's supposed to be preeminent. You can tell which way the artist was leaning when all this came through as well. So you have supposedly this too, and of course what this leads to are clashes. For example, okay, here's one of the classic ones. Europe is dominated by a system we call feudalism, which basically everybody is a lord and he has vassals below him. And as a vassal, you swear your loyalty to your lord, and your lord would entrust you with basically land, territory for you to administer. What do you do with a churchman? Because you understand, churchmen in the Middle Ages were not just people in a church hierarchy. Let's just take the Archbishop of Mainz. I just picked that city there. Mainz was part of the Holy Roman Empire. The Archbishop of Mainz was not just administering a church. He actually oversaw a territory. Okay, the emperor says he's overseeing territory in my empire. Therefore, I should have a big role in deciding who does this. The Pope says, no, he is a churchman in my hierarchy. I will say who should do this. And so you have Pope and Emperor arguing who's going to choose the church officials. The classic example of this is Pope Gregory VII and Emperor Henry IV got in a big argument over this. And finally, Gregory said, I declare you are no longer emperor. I'm going to come to Germany. We're going to elect a new emperor. And there was enough political support among Henry's enemies for this idea that Henry had to do something. So Henry literally rushes to head off the Pope at the pass. And really it was a pass through the Alps Mountains at a place called Canossa. And at Canossa, Henry came and stood in the snow for 3 days as a public penitent for his sins, so that finally the Pope, who was there, forgave him for this, restored him to his throne. And ever since that time, Canossa has been a big symbol of the church humiliating the state, the church asserting itself over the state. Now, that's not a perfect example. In fact, right after that, what happened was that Henry, as soon as he was back, he kicked Gregory out and put another pope in, which didn't last very well, and drove Gregory out of Rome for a time. But the fact is, ultimately, the weight seemed to be for the church, toward the church in all of these fights as well. The thing you should, I think, pick up on this right now is that essentially, political power became a corrupting force for the church. A number of years ago, I guess about 40 years ago, there was a Catholic writer named Malachi Martin. He's kind of an interesting character. He was a traditionalist Catholic, former Jesuit, kind of flaky, to be honest with you. But he wrote this book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Church, where basically he suggests that what really brought corruption and trouble to the church was the embrace of political power. And in fact, he was rather happy that in the 19th century, the church lost its last remnant of political power there, because it could be a chance for the Catholic Church to cleanse itself. We're not going there. But this whole idea then that the political power corrupted the church and brought it into conflicts, clashes, power grabs, and things as well. Certainly the reformers would have agreed with this, and in fact they said so quite often then. So what about the Reformation? How do we have church and state in the Reformation? We have what are called sometimes, the term often used is the magisterial reformers. Magisterial refers to magistrate, a government official. The president of the United States is the chief magistrate of the United States. And the reformers all said basically, mostly said, We've got to do reform through the magistrates. If we're going to reform the church, we do have to have, of course, preaching. We have to have teaching. We have to have the renewal of the gospel. But outwardly, at least, we've got to have the government also backing this, enforcing this, and going along. And essentially, the reformers, again, for the most part, said we've got to maintain the Constantinian settlement. I mean, we've had state churches for 1,200 years, more or less, in Europe now. So that's all they're used to. And the reformers say this is what we need to be doing here as well. We want Protestant churches, you know, doctrinally, but we want state Protestant churches. It's interesting. I mentioned John Fox, the famous English historian of the Reformation. Fox had a, an unusual view of prophecy. Basically, well, I don't get all the details, but one of the characteristics is that he thought the millennium began with Constantine. Now, one of the things we would think, I don't know if anybody in here, whatever your prophetic view is, I don't think probably anybody here would think the millennium did not begin with Constantine. Because, you know, Constantine ended persecution. It stopped it. Constantine gave support. He gave favor. And so to their way of thinking, quite often, this was a good thing. But there were others who didn't think so, as we'll see in a moment. Now, if you look at Luther and Zwingli and Calvin and the others, they differed sometimes in exactly how the church was related to the state. They differed sometimes in how much independence the church had from the state. Excuse me. But they all believed, yeah, you need to have an established church, an official state-supported church here as well. But there was some dissent from that idea in the Reformation. And that comes from preeminently the Anabaptists and then also, to a degree, the English separatists. Now, Anabaptist. The fact is, Anabaptist is a very difficult term to define. What it means at root is you don't believe in infant baptism. And that's pretty much common across the board. But there's a wide range of what some of them taught. Some of them were communitarians, you know, almost like sort of living in a socialist, communist type structure. Others were much more close to what we think was an evangelical church base. Others were spiritualist into some kinds of mysticism here. But there were a couple of things that they joined in. And one is what they call the idea of soul liberty. You cannot make anybody believe. You cannot make anybody have faith. You cannot coerce somebody in spiritual matters. Now, the reformers would say, of course, well, no, you cannot coerce someone into faith, but you can require them to belong to the church and to join the church. The Anabaptists basically said, no, only people who choose to should associate with the church, who choose to become a part of it here as well. And, of course, this is a revolutionary idea. It's against the history of the past 1,000 years in Europe as well. Soul liberty, I say, is the term used there. Sometimes, especially in the United States, this develops into the expression separation of church and state. Basically, they said the church and the state are separate societies. The state has a God-ordained authority, but it doesn't have any authority over the church. The church is not part of it as well. This is the idea that the Anabaptists put forward. And then also, likewise, in England, we have developing a little bit later the separatist movement. You know, the separatists, the Pilgrims of Plymouth Colony were separatists, probably the most famous separatist in American history. The Baptists, as they develop and grow at this time. The Quakers, likewise, the Friends. These are all groups that say, essentially, the state should not be involved in the running of the church. Now, you know, the Puritans were there, and the Puritans were saying, we want a purified church, but they still wanted a purified, established church. The separatists said, we don't want an established church at all. And so there was, at this time, then a testimony to an idea of separating church from state at that point here. We also want to note that in the Reformation, there was a growth of religious toleration here. Now, toleration is the idea that, well, we will allow someone to dissent from the majority faith. Toleration says we will let some people do something differently religiously, even though it's not what we officially endorse as a nation here as well. And we have examples of this going along. It's usually thought that by the end of the Reformation, the most tolerant country in Europe was the Netherlands. It was one of the places that you wanted to live, whatever. Even Jews were able to find toleration in the Netherlands for a time, and that's pretty unusual at that time in history. I always point out the fact the Pilgrims, you know, when the Pilgrims went and sailed to what became the Plymouth Colony, They didn't leave from England. They left from the Netherlands. They'd been living in the Netherlands for 10 years because the Netherlands had more religious toleration than England did. Now, they did stop on England on the way, so there was that stopover there. But the fact is, it was a place to live if you wanted to find at least relative toleration, even though they had an official Dutch Reformed established church there as well. And then for us, getting closer to American history, in the late 1600s, we have in England the Act of Toleration. Okay, here I'm going to just quickly skip over. In the late 1600s, Parliament threw out King James II of England because he was a Catholic, and I won't get into all the details there. And they called to the throne James's daughter Mary and her husband William, the ruler of the Netherlands, and they ruled as William and Mary. That's where William and Mary College comes from, for example, named after them. And William and his forces defeated the forces of James and it defended the Protestant succession in England, and it had all these ramifications. And one of them was this. Parliament passed an act of toleration, which basically allowed not everybody, Catholics, for example, still were under disabilities for a long time into the 19th century, but basically allowed a lot more tolerance to other groups. So Baptists, Presbyterians, Independents, so on, could live and worship in England with some limitations upon them. All right, so that act of toleration was really kind of an important breakthrough for the United Kingdom. Well, that wasn't the United Kingdom yet. For England, 20 years later, it was the United Kingdom. That's the problem with teaching history. You start thinking, oh, no, that's not precisely accurate. I should tell them. And then you think, they don't care. Passing this legislation became important. So that brings us then to the story of America and its Constitution. Now, I want to start first of all here. Let me pause. I've been going zipping along here. Are there any questions so far before I get into this point? You know, this is kind of the climax, what we're dealing with. Okay, well, when I get done, I'll also be, should have time to take questions then, I think. We look at America before it was the United States in the colonial period, and we can see different contributions for people toward religious liberty and specifically the idea of separation of church and state. One of the great earliest promoters here, put it this way, the Baptists are often seen as one of the great advocates of separation of church and state in the colonial period, quite rightly. And one of the important spokesmen of that was Roger Williams. Now, to be fair, Williams was only a Baptist rather briefly, and there are other figures who were more important to the building of the Baptist denomination here. But Williams was important because he was the first great theorist of separation of church and state. He came to Puritan Massachusetts, got in a huge argument with Massachusetts authorities over church-state issues, which I won't go into here as well. He got driven out and went to Rhode Island, or founded what became Rhode Island, Providence Plantations, it was called. And Providence Plantations allowed religious liberty. I mean, basically saying we're not going to have an established church like Massachusetts. Because Massachusetts, even though it was Puritan, it was an established Puritan church there as well, Congregationalist in that case. And it wasn't, actually, Massachusetts didn't get rid of its established church until the 19th century, after the Constitution was adopted. But that's another story. So Williams, though, was a great defender here of the idea of the separation of church and state, and helped then, as I say, to inspire the founding of Rhode Island, one of the first havens for religious liberty in colonial North America. But soon to outdistance them in some way were the Quakers. William Penn was given an allotment of land by the English king, which of course is today called Pennsylvania. The Quakers likewise were very strong advocates of religious liberty. And so Pennsylvania became kind of an even bigger haven to all these groups who were wondering, who looked for a place of refuge here. I mean, it's interesting. Rhode Island, you know, whatever else you say, but it's kind of small. I remember how many years ago it was. Our daughter's in the Navy, and my wife and I went up to Newport for her graduation from Officer Development School. Remember, we landed at Providence at the airport. We were getting our rental car, and the guy said, "Well, what brings you to our little state? You know, so why would anybody come to Rhode Island?" We told them why and everything. See, it's kind of small. Pennsylvania, okay, is much bigger. And Pennsylvania, therefore, provided a haven for all sorts of groups from Europe because the Friends, the Quakers, would allow this kind of liberty, this kind of practice in this way. It's interesting, the Baptists, even though Rhode Island was their first center, their major colonial center by the 1700s was Philadelphia. That was their main center for basically publication, church organization, efforts at church planting, and so on. Well, because Pennsylvania was this open, rich territory to which so many people flocked as well. Maryland actually became an early haven of religious liberty, though for different reasons. Maryland was basically founded as a colony, as a refuge for Catholics. The fact is that the English monarchs had a lot of sympathy, especially under the Stuarts, for Catholicism. They weren't openly Catholic. Was it Charles II, I think? Maybe he converted in his deathbed, I recall, or something. But basically, they were still outwardly Protestant, but they kept trying to find some way to get relief. And so they said, hey, we'll give you this colony there, and it could be, you know, freedom. But the fact is, if you just said this is a colony for Catholics, that would have been very controversial, obviously, back in those days. So they said, we're going to have complete religious for everybody, including the Catholics. So it may have been somewhat pragmatic, but Maryland was one of the earliest places to have a great deal of open religious freedom, religious liberty in this way. Now, you may be saying, well, did the Presbyterians have anything to do with it? And the answer is, well, Presbyterians didn't run any colonies. I mean, there were numerous in several colonies, particularly in the back country of places like the Carolinas, Virginia, and so on. But there even then was at least one notable case, Francis McKimmy. Maybe you've heard of McKimmy somewhere. He's sometimes called the father of American Presbyterianism. He went about church planting. He was the leader of the first presbytery organized in North America, what we usually see as the beginning of the American Presbyterian Church. And one of the things that he did, he was in New York. He preached in New York, the New York colony. And the governor of New York had him arrested for violating, because New York is supposedly an Anglican colony with an established Anglican church, which you can't do anything without the permission of the Anglicans. And they arrested McKimmy. And McKimmy went to court and he defended himself on the basis that Parliament had adopted the Act of Toleration in 1689. And therefore, New York, as a colony of England, was likewise subject to it. In other words, he said, Parliament's Act of Toleration applies to the colonies as well. And the court decision came down in his favor for that. So it's seen as an important precedence that colonial authorities in the New World had to likewise follow at least the guidelines of what Parliament had said in that Act of Toleration. So you have these different contributors, you have these different markers, that sort of thing as well. So that brings us then to the Constitution. And the question comes up here, the First Amendment of the Constitution, particularly the religious liberty that we have in this country, what are its roots? What's the source of that? Where did they get that? And the fact is, it's actually several things. Sometimes when people start arguing about this, they kind of get into one cause. For example, quite often what you read, say, in a secular textbook, it's a result of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment in the 18th century was this stress on reason, stress on liberty, usually kind of a distancing of itself to religion or changing religion into something more rational sounding like deism or something. But the idea is the Enlightenment was much more in favor of tolerance and liberty, and so Americans took that and incorporated that. Well, as a factor, that's pretty important to keep in mind. Certainly we see the influence of that on people like, say, Thomas Jefferson and others. But there's more than just that. Of course, there was the whole English heritage. I mean, the fact is that the founders of the United States were, for the most part, people of English descent. So they borrowed from English common law. They had the English Acts of Toleration. There were other matters in the background there that were shaping them. And their religious influences. We don't want to ignore the fact that there were people, and let's credit the Baptists, the Quakers, and others where they did this, who were saying we should have religious liberty. We have been trying to establish a pattern of religious liberty in these colonies now to become the states of the United States, or had become the states of the United States by this point as well. It's interesting, I'm going to give you a quotation in a couple of minutes here from Thomas Jefferson. But it's interesting, Jefferson wrote that in a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association of Connecticut, because basically the Baptists thought of Jefferson as one of their heroes because he was defending religious liberty. Separation of church and state, as we said here. So, what does it mean? Well, the First Amendment says, as you know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, there's a whole constitutional history that you could get into, which would be probably be beyond me. Perhaps Dr. Matzko, with his legal history background, could give you more of the details. But essentially, there's two things we want to note here. One is the fact that there were no religious establishments. There's no state church. We're not going to have a Church of the United States, which everybody will give taxes to support, in which you could get out of it, opt out of it. But in other words, that's going to be our official church. We don't have that. We don't allow that. Now, as I said, the states were still allowed to have theirs after the adoption of the Constitution up until the Civil War. Another story. And in fact, Connecticut and Massachusetts maintained their state churches for a few years after the Constitution was adopted. But of course, today, nobody has any such thing. But also, and this is where it differs from religious toleration, it was equality of religions. In other words, all religions are equal. Every religion has an equal right, has an equal place in the American scene. In fact, some say this makes America into a religious free market, so that anybody can start a religion who wants to. You think of Joseph Smith and the Mormons, start your own religion and, boom. And the fact is, this is one of the after effects of all of this as well. But what exactly does it mean? And that's what we've been arguing about in some ways for a lot of years since then. What does it mean to say that we have no establishment or prohibiting the free exercise thereof? And there have been all kinds of court cases, legislation, and other trying to deal with this. So I thought I would illustrate it very simply with a metaphor. A metaphor you may have heard of sometime called the wall of separation. Now, if I say wall of separation, some of you may think, okay, Thomas Jefferson, I think, and you're right, by the way. And some of you think, oh, Supreme Court, and you're right about that as well. But it's interesting. Let me just give you three occasions where this wall of separation metaphor has been used. First of all, the earliest was Roger Williams. Roger Williams in the 1600s there in New England said, when Christians have opened a gap in the hedge or wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world, God hath ever broken down the wall itself, removed the candlestick, and made his garden a wilderness as at this day. Now, this is Williams' indictment of the Puritans here. You people have violated this wall, this hedge that God put between the church and the world, and it's corrupting the church. Now, the question is, Thomas Jefferson, we'll see in a moment, used that expression. Did he know Roger Williams said that? I kind of doubt it. I've never seen any indication that he came across it. But nonetheless, he also used that, as I said, in a letter to a group of Baptists in Connecticut who were supporting him. And he said, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. And of course, what you may see here, you look in the context, Roger Williams says we need this wall of separation to protect the church from the state. Jefferson says we need a wall of separation to protect the state from the church here. And in fact, a lot of people even think this is something from the Constitution because that expression is used so much famously. The 1940s, the Supreme Court, in the decision Everson versus Board of Education, the First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. We could not approve the slightest breach. And so today, a lot of arguments over church-state issues, you'll hear that wall of separation metaphor coming up. But as I indicate here, it's kind of depending which way you look at it, which way you take it, and of course, what do you mean by not breaching it, and so on here as well. I came across a quotation from J.C. Ryle while I was working on this I thought was interesting. He says, it is certain that the church must not swallow up the state. It is no less certain that the state must not swallow up the church. And that's really kind of where we're getting at, the balance that maintains a liberty that maintains a proper, to us, biblical balance between these ideas. All right, So that's my very quick overview of this topic. Do you have questions or comments about it? Yes, sir. Okay, that's a good question. Is it possible to have a nation without a national religion? Well, obviously, in one sense, yes, because they exist. I mean, but that's not what you're talking about. Is it ideal, in other words? Is it better? And that's a tough philosophical question, because we can look at when they were having the established national religion and all the problems they had, the persecutions that resulted, corruption that it attracted. I mean, you know, a good way to become rich and famous could be to get in the service of the church, because it had this government support. On the other hand, then you look at what's the moral impact of not having a national religion. How do we have a call to a moral standard without an appeal to something? This is why some people said Americans develop what they call American civil religion, trying to have sort of a religiosity without a specific theological content. If you want to go straight by the data, neither has worked perfectly. The question is, what works in a world of fallen people where you have human depravity pitted against human depravity? I'm not sure. I think it's a provocative question. And if I had to answer it, I would still come down on the side of separation of church and state. But it is a legitimate question to say, how do we deal with these things? How do we approach them? How do you have a national morality apart from religion? Because really, you don't have that. And we may be, and of course, we look at the contemporary situation and think, well, maybe we're seeing the fruit of that now. Yeah, a lot of people are, but a lot of people are just kind of it's a de facto humanism. You know, that not so much that they're professing like the card-carrying secular humanists do. Here, this is what you should follow the humanist manifesto. It's just a matter of, we don't think about it. It's almost like their religion, in a sense, is a practical atheism quite often there as well. So the question is, of course, if you look back in, say, medieval Europe, where they had an official religion, how much did that really affect the quality of the life, the morals there as well? I'm not sure we've had a perfect model in history, I'll say that. And that may mean that we still need to be looking and figuring and gathering and taking the information. Well, we always come back to the point that history is not our absolute guideline. Of course, Scripture is. History can give us examples. History can give us some suggestions. But, you know, history does not determine for us what everybody ought to do. It gives us the data for discussing that. And, of course, we as Christians come back ultimately, what does the Scripture have to say about this? And so what you need, in a sense, I guess, is a biblical discussion of church-state, which is a little more I can get into in 2 or 3 minutes, and I'm not sure I'm up to it anyway. It's a good question, though. Yes, sir. A radical. I mean, you had some of this before, and the United States before France had declared a separation. But you do have almost, I guess what you have in the French Revolution is actually, as you're saying, an antipathy. I mean, the United States, we had separation of church and state, but the founding fathers all thought religion was a good thing in one way or another. Some were very devout men. Others thought it was pragmatically a good thing. In the French Revolution, you have an actual resistance to rejection of, in this case, the Catholic Church. So, yeah, in some ways that is. And then, of course, 150 years later, you have the Communist Revolution, where it's even more extreme. The total eradication of religion is part of your goal there as well. So, yeah, I think that's not a bad observation there. It doesn't have to be that radical, but that was certainly one of the first radical ones. Yes, sir.
Just an observation that perhaps you can correct, if it's incorrect. mm-hmm. and maybe waging some wars against some external enemies, to a secular humanist state where the material world is all that matters, and therefore the regulations of the secular state, practically speaking, are totally encompassing of human life. And the church is kind of getting squeezed out to the side. And now when there's separation of church and state, we're not just talking about this manager and that manager, and they have different jurisdictions. State is basically a synonym for public life in the minds of many people.
Yeah. I think you have a point there, because you know, the basic development of the state, the growth of the state, the state's reach is one of the things you have to work through. I'd still say in a democratic system, you still have a certain liberty of sphere. You know, totalitarian states like the Nazis, the communists, they really did try to say everything is the state and nothing was allowed any dissent from it.
Right, they were explicit about it. They were
extreme. I'm not sure it's quite so, well, certainly not so extreme, certainly, here. There was some who would disdain the idea of any religious idea or influence, anything being other than prevalent, but there are still people who would advocate, usually on the conservative side of the political spectrum, a place for the religious voice in the public sphere there as well. So it's an ongoing battle, and right now it does seem like the state has an overreach, perhaps. But on the other hand, there are still others who would, currently the Supreme Court in the last few years has made a couple of minor decisions about allowing, you know, funds to go to religious schools and things, which seem to be, they wouldn't have done that in 1947 with the Supreme Court. So where it's going to go, well, I always say historians are not prophets, and I'm not going to try and predict. We're past our time here. I don't want Mr. Farr to tell, imagine Mr. Farr talking about me going late. But anyway, we'll stop. If you do have some other questions, I'll be glad to answer. I'll be here between the services, obviously, if there's something else you'd like to ask about. But let's go ahead and close in prayer and end this session. Lord, we do indeed thank you for your word as our guide, and help us, Lord, to realize that it is the truth of your word, the scripture, that is going to lead us, and the Holy Spirit will take this to shape our thinking and our minds. And help us, Lord, to see the right path and to make proper discernment, proper choices as well. Now bless us in the services to come this day, if we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.